All right. Well, welcome to Frontside, the podcast, episode 18. This time we have an amazing special guest, superstar developer. I'm sure he'll say the same. He'll say, yes, I'm a superstar. Torin Billups is with us. So hi, Torin. Welcome.
Hey, guys. What's up?
Hi. And Stanley Stewart is co-hosting today. Hi, Stanley.
Hey.
And I'm Brandon. This should be fun. Torin, we're glad to have you on, man. How's it going?
Oh, dude, I'm just so humbled. You're one of my programming heroes, no joke. So just jazzed to be on the show, man.
Stanley will tell you I'm literally the worst at everything except for being a dad. And I'm pretty good at that.
By the end of this call, you'll just be so sick of dads.
Yeah.
That's cool, man. I listened to the last episode, and actually as a dad myself, I was like, dude, I should totally be on this podcast.
I can buy a ukulele. I don't own one, but you could get a ukulele. You could, go to water parks, all the dad stuff. Learn to mow the grass more. I don't know. You're already a dad, so that works out.
Yeah, I just try and avoid the dad stuff usually. In fact, there's always something around the house that I just don't know how to do. I'm literally the worst. All I know how to do is computers, so sorry.
So, yeah, you won't be a good fit for the dad cast because mostly we just like to complain about how things used to be just slightly better than they are now. So no, we wanted to have you on for a specific purpose. Actually, there's some, to talk more about backend developers, how backend developers are starting to move toward more of the front end. Before we do that, tell us a little bit about yourself. I actually, when I came to EmberConf last year, you were one of the few people that I was like, oh my gosh, I know you from the internet. I know you from stuff you do. That's so cool. I'm a big fan of your work. So. Tell us a little bit about some of the stuff people may have heard of or some of the stuff that you've done that they may not have heard of that you've liked or stuff like that.
Yeah, that's interesting that first that you thought I was famous because I'm certainly not famous. But it was obviously great to meet you last year, and I'm looking forward to going this year as well as also be speaking there this year. It'll be a lot of fun. My background, I was doing a lot of C++ and Java in college. I have a computer science undergrad, came out of school, didn't really fit into the programming thing. In fact, I wasn't really sure I was going to enjoy programming full time. So I was kind of in a weird job where I did some programming and then some sysadmin stuff. And eventually I sort of started building web apps and fell in love with the web app thing and bounced around different .NET and Java gigs, did some Python for a couple of years, which suddenly, up in Iowa anyway, you do Python for 2 or 3 years and you're nearly unemployed, which is basically what happened. So then I tried to kind of specialize or do the more like specialist role instead of being a generalist and just do JavaScript full time. And unfortunately, within 2 months, I fell on my face there and ended up trying to do the exact opposite and do a lot more full stack stuff, still doing JavaScript, obviously, but doing a fair amount of back-end work as well.
And you were one of the first people, and we don't need to get into this system. I actually want to have you back after, I don't want to spoil your EmberConf talk because you're doing a lot of stuff about TDD, but you were one of the first people I saw doing Ember and testing together. And it was a lot more difficult back then than it is now, but I thought that was really cool. Clearly, you were bringing some engineering practices that are more associated historically with back-end development into front-end development. And there was something about that appealed to me in terms of building stuff that you can be confident in and you know is going to be high quality for long periods of time, that kind of stuff. How did you personally kind of get into that stuff? And am I reading that right, that you kind of brought some of those practices from back-end style development?
Yeah, I mean, I'm definitely more of a back-end developer from right out of college. But yeah, somewhere back in way 2007, I think, I was my first full-time programming job. And I would say I wasn't really surrounded by great mentors. I didn't know there was this great open source community. I'd never been to a user group. Hadn't really experienced what I think of now as mentors outside of the organization, or basically a healthy balance of people inside the organization that want to grow you, and then finding mentors and just other professionals outside of your company that can grow you from, get you introduced to open source and TDD. And that's essentially what happened is started meeting some people outside of work who were very interested in quality, and I'd never actually thought about quality, which is really sad, but again, no judgment here because it was my first job. And yeah, the real sad part is actually the internal folks I thought that were kind of guiding me were very much not interested in quality. And it's basically just the environment or the culture that I was in at that company where we had to get things done leadership was more command and control and very much the waterfall style. But this friend of mine was sort of getting me interested in TDD. We were doing .NET way back then, and there was a sort of underground movement in the .NET community where there was like the alt.NET community, if you remember that.
Yeah, I definitely do. There were a lot of great developers in there, and some cool MVC frameworks like Fubu MVC fell out of that. And there was a cool alt.NET podcast that a friend of mine, Mike Moore, used to be involved with. I wasn't a programmer yet, but I was in a .NET shop, and so I remember all that stuff.
Yeah, so you probably know the divide that existed back then. It was very much the traditional .NET developer who didn't really see the value, and I think it was more or less I'm not familiar, so I don't like this, and I've been programming for X years, so this must not work because I've been successful the last 10, 20 years without it, so why would I need it now? And ultimately, that was the culture I was up against. And so really what I did probably the last 6 months at this particular company was try and get introduced to I wouldn't call it TDD, but just quality. Why did quality matter?
Well, why do you need quality if you have like a 40-person QA team, right?
We didn't even have that. Yeah, we had people that just didn't want to go home, which was very strange. So I basically just got interested in that from this one particular story where I remember it's like any company when you're a new programmer, they sort of just throw you into something to see if you're going to sink or swim from a problem solving perspective. And I remember looking at this problem for a day or so and being like, I have no idea. It was the most obscure code I'd ever seen. I hadn't really been a professional programmer very long. I didn't know a thing about patterns or what kind of mess I had truly stepped in. And the thing that really sunk in is I went to talk to my boss and I said, I'm not really sure how this works. Is there some way I can see it or verify it? And he was like, you should probably go talk to this guy, Randy. He wrote this. And I was like, all right. So I went and talked to this particular guy, and he was like, after like a half hour talking to him and working with him, he's like, I don't even know what this code does. And I remember like, okay, if you don't know what it does and you wrote it just a couple months ago, I will certainly not know what this does. And I started thinking back to how did developers actually come back to code after it exists for a certain amount of time, whether that's 2 weeks, 2 months, 2 years. And I honestly started to sort of question if I would make it in the game of software because I was too afraid to change any of the code that I was working on. And that's really one of the big tenets of TDD, right, is initially without it, you have this fear to refactor and change code. Mm-hmm. So often what you have happen in systems is you start copying and pasting without coming back and reducing or drying it up. So you have this code rot that begins to happen, and it's purely based out of fear. Because you're too afraid to say, well, I don't really know if I reuse this and extract a couple classes. I don't really know if what the other guy wrote last week actually still works. So I'm just going to copy and paste his, make those couple tweaks that make my code a little bit different. And then no one will be the wiser. There wasn't code reviews. There wasn't pairing, the things we have now.
I'm waiting for you to say, and that's when I started drinking.
Well, there's always drinking, right?
There's drinking and crying.
I think just from there, I just got really interested in there has to be a better way. I'm just a very passionate person. And if there is a better way, I want to learn about it. I want to get better. And ultimately, that's what bit me on the server side when I was doing a lot of early testing, just kind of test after, really. And then after that particular job, I started learning test first and the different trials of, anyway, the whole story about TDD. But yes, my experience, I think, came mainly from the server side. Because that's the back end sort of work that I was doing, and I just wanted to do it well.
Okay, that's interesting. So you basically kind of discovered some of these some of the techniques for building software that lets you basically sleep at night and understand what's going on more than 2 weeks after you wrote it. And for me, honestly, sometimes it's more than like 2 days. You lose context and you have no idea. I had this experience today, what is this supposed to do? And I'm like, I don't know. I wrote that software like 4 weeks ago. I have no idea. It was a different me.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of phases, right? Early on when I first started learning TDD, I really got hooked on the religion of it from the test first angle. So once I got beyond quality and started trying to actually do test-driven development, I noticed that for some reason, the religious piece where it was like, this is a silver bullet. You know what I'm talking about?
I was raised in the Ruby community, so yes.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So that piece of it really hooked me for a long time. And it almost probably drove me the wrong direction where at some point I was writing tests just to have tests and writing tests just to have 100% coverage. And you almost go so far on that that path that you actually have fear in your software to change it for other reasons. So as I talked about earlier, fear was mainly I wasn't sure if I would break something from the behavioral perspective. I didn't know if I could break or if I would break production code by refactoring. And what happens on the other side when you get religious is you have so many just horribly mocked out tests just to achieve a coverage percent number that you have the same fear, except it's the fear of breaking a bunch of very brittle mock heavy tests. So.
Mm-hmm. So for my part, my experience with TDD was basically that it was like Catholic guilt of programming. Like I was born with it because when I first started learning to program, I was learning in Ruby. And the shop that I worked at proudly wore the name Cowboy Coders. They're like, yeah, we're Cowboy Coders. That, you know, and they wore it with like, hey, we're, you know, like the American West or whatever. So they were, you know, rebellious against this culture of TDD that was there. But my very first job that I went to start programming, everybody just felt the pressure from this community. They didn't know what it meant. They didn't know what it was. And so when I did start testing, it was exactly what you're saying. I was testing things like whether a variable existed once it was instantiated. You know, like just stuff that doesn't – there was a bunch of stuff that I was testing the framework that I was working in instead of the code, that behavior of the code. I just didn't know what I was doing, and it turned me off of testing for quite some time. And so my problem once I started moving toward the front end was – I had finally gotten somewhat comfortable. There are increasingly good resources in back-end technologies for how to test your stuff. And when I came to the front end, nobody was doing it. Nobody anywhere was testing their JavaScript. It was an unthinkable proposition to test your JavaScript. I think, Stanley, you had this experience. Like, it was the weirdest thing. I heard a story coming from the people that had interviewed Stanley at his first professional job. Do you want to tell that story, Stanley?
Sure. I mean, it's pretty short. They just asked me to like implement map in CoffeeScript. And I was like, okay, can I borrow your computer? And like, this was when Node was pretty new, but I just basically like did NPM install Mocha and the CoffeeScript thing and kind of wrote some failing tests first to kind of make sure things didn't work. And then like array map was already defined because Node is ES5. And that was a little confusing, but so we just decided to rename the method. But yeah, people seem like I like coding interviews where you get to actually code instead of like put stuff on a whiteboard. So testing really helps that because it kind of helps you, especially for like simple stuff like implement map. It's like, you know what the end goal is, and then you kind of have like a set of steps to get you toward the implementation.
And so the story that I heard back from them was like everybody's brains melted. It was just this kid came in and in his interview and test drove his interview questions in JavaScript. And I was like, you can test JavaScript? And they're like, apparently there's this new generation of developers. They're testing their JavaScript. So what's so cool about it is I was so intimidated by that I actually, and I don't know if you, when you get into like having shared this with some people that you brought from the back end toward the front end, but a lot of back end developers that I know treated JavaScript with such disdain that the idea of testing it was like, I had a bias against testing it because I felt like, surely it's impossible to test your JavaScript because JavaScript is garbage. I don't know if you've had that experience or if you've met that kind of resistance.
Yeah, I think there's a ton of resistance to that because a lot of the back-end developers or teams that I work with, they come actually from a static background as well. So in addition to just JavaScript being a very broken language, as it's seen from the back-end usually, there's also this idea that, well, it's also a dynamic language, which means it's unmaintainable by its very nature. So why would we try and improve the quality that we're kind of stuck in a bad place already with JavaScript? So, but I think that comes to the coaching side or, you know, depending on what role you play on the team. If you're just there to learn and you're certainly not the senior guy, it's often hard to fight back or battle against it. But when you're on a team of people who are willing to listen, in fact, ultimately, that's what's happened on the team I'm in is we sort of discuss the value of the tests that we're writing because I think in addition to it just being JavaScript, a lot of back-end programmers also don't see a great amount of value in testing user interfaces. And I think it comes from most of the user interfaces they built back in the day were just forms over data where it's like, well, this is really just a database table on a web page. There's a save button and a cancel button. What do I need to test here? And what I think is missing is really educating those back-end developers that user interfaces of years ago are definitely not what's there today, and the screens are more and more complex. So without tests, sort of that to that comment you mentioned earlier, how do you sleep at night? And that's ultimately the biggest challenge. I think I've almost spoiled myself for any job ever in the future, which is if I'm ever working on some code, if I'm going to make a change to it, sort of like Stanley's interview there, you definitely want to have a failure to show the bug right away, or you want to have a failure to show the missing feature and then drive that out. And ultimately, when you're done, you're obviously going to do some refactoring and play the Boy Scout, clean some things up. And how do you know at the end of that that you haven't broken anything? So it sort of just blows my mind that people aren't testing. That's sort of how far I am on the other side of it now.
And I think you probably play enough in the real world to know huge percentages, if not of probably strong majority of apps that are built in JavaScript are not currently tested. It's sort of a relatively new and still a little controversial of a concept. I know a lot of JavaScript programmers that think that testing is not necessarily a valuable thing. It doesn't take much to convince somebody because you work in a code base with tests, with good tests that don't break a ton. And you can keep moving 6 months after you start versus you have to stop and start over. So there's a pretty big difference. And I think a lot of backend, I actually credit people like you who have come from the backend and said, hey, listen, a lot of JavaScript developers haven't experienced code, very large JavaScript code bases yet. And as JavaScript code bases increase in size and complexity, they're starting to look more like and take on more jobs like backend systems. And because of that, you know, the stuff is starting to need to be decoupled and treated like services and individually tested and tested from a behavior side backwards. And so some of those ideas around test-driven development are coming out. But also, just in general, there's a lot of challenges in bringing people from that are more familiar with backend stuff into JavaScript, not least of which is sometimes there's a bias against the language in general. And I'm curious to know what you do to mentor and coach and help teams of people. Because I think, if I understand correctly, that's a lot of what you're doing right now. Is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, I'm really just playing the role of a peer. You know, I'm certainly not like an expert on this team. The only expert or expertise that I bring is that I've worked with Ember a lot. And obviously, we're using Ember for some of the front-end work we do. So the biggest thing I would say is if you come into a role and you want to be mentoring someone, one of the big pieces that's going to guarantee you're successful is if you can get buy-in on your team or within your company to do pairing full-time. I've been pairing full-time since 2009, and I don't even know how you work without a pair anymore. I'm that broken, honestly. And I think as far as the team I'm on now and the role I have helping mentor the guys that I work with on a daily basis, it's actually great because they're equally mentoring me on the back-end stuff. So it's not like I come in and you have the very senior guy who knows the whole stack and he's just mentoring the entry level guy. And so you have that big break, you know, a couple hours in where the very senior guy is just, you know, his bored out of his mind and the very junior guy or entry level person's head is exploding and they're sort of full for the day. Mm-hmm. This way around instead, because we're doing a lot of full stack, we'll spend, you know, a little bit of time doing some JavaScript stuff. And that's where I'm doing some mentoring. And then we'll eventually have to implement the back end of that and they'll do some mentoring back on me. And I think it's just actually a very healthy relationship to be full stack for that very reason. So you're delivering not just code. That's one of the things I feel like I've learned in the last 6 to 12 months is, you know, if I just built the user interface as just the front end guy and all I delivered was the front end code, is that really valuable? You know, I think customers, especially in the consulting arena, they're really paying for value. They're not necessarily paying for code. So I think just the full stack argument itself has a lot of weight because I can't just deliver the front end. I can't just deliver the mocked up, you know, oh, I'll throw that over the wall to the server side guys. So when we pair full time, you know, they obviously may not have the appreciation for the front end that I do, but I also sometimes may not have the appreciation for the amount of effort that goes into the back end. So when we work together and part of that being the pairing process, I think it's just the best for both of us. And I think these guys, some of the challenges, if you want to get into that piece of it, really just come down to not necessarily Ember, but a single page app. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of, I remember listening to Ruby on Rails podcast, where Brian was on there talking about, you know, can you sell Ember? And I was like, well, I don't know if I can really sell Ember, but, you know, I could sell the concept or the idea of a single page app. And I think that is ultimately what I spend most of my time mentoring. So for instance, one big thing that I think a lot of people have been doing traditional server-generated development, it's just hard to come across in their mind, is that you have routes on the client. And if I open the Chrome DevTools, I clear the network tab, and then I click a route, and the URL changes, the page changes, but they look over at the network tab and there's nothing there.
Yeah.
They're not really accustomed to that. So I spent a lot of time actually kind of describing how single page apps work, the trade-offs, because it's obviously not a silver bullet in itself, and there are bad places for single page apps. But a lot of the work that I do, I think, falls into the pit of success for single page apps, where it's sort of behind the firewall. The experience you get when you're behind the firewall, if you have an app that boots up once, and in effect, the users are in this app all day, usually the trade-off is a win for the single page app story. But I certainly try and be honest with people too, that I don't have all the answers, and that a lot of my experience has been more behind a login prompt. I'm not building Amazon.com, you know, so there's obviously different challenges and probably a whole different set of mentoring that comes with trying to do something like Amazon versus, you know, a more aligned business app that's behind a login somewhere.
Mm-hmm. And so when you're working with these teams, you kind of shuffle back and forth between front end and back end. And that's kind of my experience. When I'm doing too much of one or the other, I wind up mentally discounting the other. So when I'm doing a ton of back end development, I start thinking that front end development must be really easy. And when I'm doing too much front end development, I start thinking, oh yeah, back end stuff is really easy. Just give me that API.
The grass is greener, right?
Yeah, I guess so. Like, you just mentally, I don't know what it is, but you spend time enough away from it. And then you go in and you're like, give me that. I'll make the API myself. And you're like, oh my gosh, this is so hard. It's there's a little bit of grass is greener. It does doing one thing I think that is really cool about bringing back end developers into the front end. We've been doing some of this lately at the front side where we're training some people that are more traditionally back end and they're doing more front end. It really gives you the gift of an understanding for quality API design, because you start going, just give me this data in a way that I expect, and making your back end developers consumers of their own API is a really awesome way to get them to care about the quality of that API, I've found.
Yeah, absolutely. I think also not being able to, or not having the luxury to say, I just build the back end, mm-hmm. I don't care how this front end comes together, or I just build the front end, I don't care how those guys put the API together. It's a whole different appreciation and really a whole different behavior from a team perspective. So when you don't have the ability to throw something over the wall, you have a lot more respect for the people who are doing the back end work, you know, because I still probably do less back end work compared to some of the other guys on the team because they're just better at it. In fact, the back end tech stack that we have, I have never worked in. So there's, you know, I'm still obviously, like any good team, you want more the T-shaped individual, meaning that they have a very broad set of skills, but when necessary, there is one person or hopefully one or two people that can dive very deep on a given subject. And I lean on these guys for a lot of the back end stuff, as well as they lean on me for a lot of the front end single page app stuff. So I think there's a good healthy balance in there. And like you were saying, the appreciation side is just sort of a funny, from the sidelines, you can see it in yourself. Hopefully you can appreciate that after the fact. But I think when you have to produce both the front end, the back end in a quality way, and then deliver it end to end, there's just something about that that for me personally has just been a real joy in the last year.
I can say for sure, like my experience working specifically with Stanley, I was so focused on when I first met Stanley, I was focused primarily on doing server rendered stuff. And so anytime I ventured into JavaScript, I would just complain so much. And I could see it just drove him bonkers because Stanley, correct me if I'm wrong, but you started doing, when I met you, you had, were mostly doing back end development. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, my experience has mostly been like hosting WordPress and PHP and more recently Rails.
So you're one of the few people I know. So you're at this point, like for the last few years anyway, you're primarily a JavaScript developer. And then I'll look over and you're doing stuff with Docker and Vagrant and, you know, DevOpsy type stuff, Puppet. And it's staggering to me to see. And it's sort of humbling for me as a person who gets like entrenched in one thing and like, no, I have the solution. It's not, I don't care if it's a silver bullet. It's all I need to care about right now. Just because I feel like sometimes I have limited bandwidth, and I would assume that's sort of something that can be difficult to run up against.
Yeah, you definitely. I think this kind of comes to the or these points sort of play into the what makes a good team and then what separates a good team from a great team. And that very first one is sort of along the lines that you're talking about, where I only have so much bandwidth. And the thing that's sort of cropped up in my mind the last few months has been building the leanest responsible solution. So there are certainly times where developers, and I'm guilty of this in the past, where if I have a certain amount of time, I can basically gold plate a feature, or I can gold plate an application where the people who want to build it or are expecting it to be delivered this iteration, they didn't really care about some of the things that I got very focused on. And so I would go into these rabbit holes that were more or less for me. I was still delivering the feature on time usually, but I felt like I spent a lot more time just building stuff I wanted to versus this last year or so. I'm trying to really think about, am I building first the right thing? And then the second question being, am I building the right thing right now? Like, is it the right time to build this feature? Or can we do this sort of chop down the size of this feature right now and still have it be something I could deliver it to a customer and sort of deliver it to production, but have it be something we can still iterate on where I don't get stuck in these rabbit holes? And one of the other things along those lines is when you're pairing, this is actually a really good combination, because if you're by yourself, a lot of times you need this sounding board to make sure you're making the right decisions. And I think the word that comes up that really separates almost junior and senior developers is trade-off, because you're going to have to make a trade-off. You're going to make it all the time, every day. Almost every feature or bug you're working on, you're going to have some small trade-off along the way. And you have to realize you're not going to be able to actually gold plate everything. You're going to have to say, this is what we can get done right now. And then the next iteration, if this is still a priority or if this is even a thing that's still adding value, then we'll come back and do this V2.
Mm-hmm. So in bringing these people along now, you have this team and they're historically pretty much back-end developers. And you've gone through your journey of making these discoveries for yourself of understanding trade-offs and understanding some practices that help you make like some things aren't worth trading away, like being able to sleep at night. But you're trying to bring along this group of people who have varying attitudes. And I'm curious to know some of the challenges that you run into, because I assume there are other people out there that have a group of back-end developers that they're saying, hey, we can start building these single-page apps and build more robust stuff instead of everything being server-generated all the time. Bringing those people along has to come with some challenges. I'm curious to know what some of those are and how you've dealt with that.
Wow. Yeah, I think I got really lucky there, because it's funny, when I joined this team, I was really just looking to join a world-class team with the best leadership in software development. And I knew I was getting that. That was actually the only selling point for the current contract I'm on, which was amazing in itself. One of the trade-offs I made professionally at that time was actually, I was doing JavaScript full-time, but I was very unhappy. And I said, you know what? I may not be able to do JavaScript at this new job. In fact, going into it, there was actually no front-end work. But I said it didn't matter, because I was more excited to work with great people than purely one technology. So I had to almost grow up a little bit myself, where I wasn't as focused on the tech. And I think that happens to everybody, right? When you're younger, or maybe just if you are interested in something, you're very focused on that piece of technology or that problem, rather than maybe something, in this particular instance, I just wanted to work with someone who would help me deliver something. And that was the leadership that I was sort of seeking in this for this current gig I'm on. And I felt like coming into it, I was a little nervous, because obviously I still loved Ember and I was trying to still do a lot in the Ember community, but I realized if I was going to take this job, possibly giving up JavaScript, that it could be the worst thing ever. And ultimately, what came out of it was that when I showed up, what I didn't know during the interview was they did have a little bit of Angular to kind of show off some stuff. And very quickly, I just asked one of the developers, I was like, are you an expert in Angular? Do you want to continue this? And again, this is where the luck piece comes in. This guy was like, honestly, that's just a house of cards. There's no test, throw it away. You know, the culture on the team was one of the things I was also very interested in. And the entire culture is test-driven quality. So I didn't have to fight that battle and win that. And then ultimately being one of the first developers on this team, being able to throw out this Angular app that was just sort of a prototype anyway, and then start building a foundation on Ember, as one of those very first people, enabled me to, as other people came on, just slowly onboard them. Because we didn't hire like 10 people in one day, which would have been a lot more challenging. Instead, we slowly hired, you know, every couple months or every couple weeks, which allowed me to get someone just comfortable enough with it that they would also then pass down the tribal knowledge. And really, there was
to me that violates one of the fundamental laws of programming, is that you don't throw away prototypes, you put them into production, and they're your production apps forever. So something's definitely wrong. You should talk to somebody. That's kind of amazing.
I actually agree. You can't throw code. You can't throw code away. Absolutely. So
no, I'm totally messing with you. Like, but you know, like everybody's had a prototype go all the way to production. You're like, whoa, that was a prototype. There were no tests. And they're like, nope, ship it, go.
Yeah.
And so I think that speaks strongly to, so when you talk about separating good teams from great teams, is one of them is choosing the team in the first place and choosing people to work with, that you're choosing people over a technology. I've made a you know, ton of immature mistakes when I was first starting out. I had a boss who was one of my best bosses ever. Once I sat down in a room and he wanted us to switch from Ruby and Rails to Java stack. And he's like, you could use Groovy and Rails if you want, but you know, we're switching to Java. And I told him, I'm like, if you want me to be a Java developer, you're going to find yourself with a bunch, you know, you're going to lose everybody on your team. You're definitely going to lose me. And he called me out on it. He's like, that's an extraordinarily immature outlook and you should really think about that. And I did. I went home and I thought about it and I came back the next day and apologized. But it was it's totally embarrassing to think about now. But I was so wedded to being a Rubyist, to being married to this one technology. And so the fact that you selected a team that wasn't married to a specific technology but was married to shipping quality experiences and software, I think – you know, you talk about what separates good from great. One of them is the self-selection of that kind of stuff, for sure.
Yeah, well, I think that's actually the thing that scares me a little bit, because I am so picky about the culture, the team, the people, that I look around and I feel like there is a very small, you know, handful of teams that I would be a good fit on because of that. And it's proven, actually, in the last couple of years, there's definitely been teams I've joined where I came in with an expectation of quality or TDD, and very quickly found that those were things we talk about and maybe not necessarily things on this team that we do, which is kind of sad, because then I had to quit those teams. You know, I'm one of those people that I agree with you, actually. Just quitting because of a technology change now feels to me, just where I'm at my journey professionally, feels incorrect, unprofessional, immature. But quitting on principle because I want to deliver quality actually feels like I've actually done that, where I literally was like, if we're not doing this with quality in mind, I can't work here. And I have quit those jobs. So, which is kind of a negative, because like you said, there are certain trade-offs you have to make professionally. And I feel, or I hope, that I'm making the right trade-offs by, as you said, picking people over technology for now. And just so happens that with people oftentimes come opinions, attitudes, and experience. And as long as those the underlying values of that team line up with me, I'm usually happy regardless of the tech stack.
Interesting. Yeah, and I don't have the same principles. So I wouldn't be the person, I've showed up and they said, oh yeah, we believe in this and this and this test driven and da 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 and quality. And I show up and they're like, okay, now you can have access to the code base. Here's the secret. We ship garbage. And I was like, oh, I'll ship garbage. Sure. Sure. I don't have that same set of principles. And I actually think high quality software is not necessarily requisite, because sometimes what you're trying to do is flip a company or build something that doesn't need to stand the test of time or whatever as a hard and fast moral high ground. That said, the team that I work with now has definitely convinced me. Like, Stanley's standard of building software and Charles's standard of building software. And I go, wow, this is just like objectively better, because I spend less of my time worrying that somebody's going to trip over some, you know, pothole that I left and crash our application in it. And you don't get calls in the middle of the night. And
yeah. And I can certainly start out where I should, you know, prerequisite this whole thing with the disclaimer about, obviously, what I'm talking about has a very specific context. In fact, the last time, just last week, I, of course, got on Twitter and decided to talk or make some opinions known about TDD. And I got some emails and people obviously saying, you know, this is not a silver bullet. It is not always the right thing, as you just said. And I absolutely agree. I don't know the context of your business, your company, your goals, but the companies I work for, they essentially want to ship software sustainably. And like you said, there are certain engineering practices that enable teams to ship sustainably for long periods of time. And ultimately, as a consultant, the reputation I want or the code I want to leave behind is something that, in fact, my whole career, the reason I got into TDD and quality is that I've always wanted the next developer to literally walk over to my desk the day after I handed something over and then have that person give me a pat on the back and say, wow, this is a joy to work on, dude. Thanks, you know, like, for taking the time. So That like in a sentence, in a phrase, is my entire career, my motivation, everything.
Oh, I see. You want to make people happy. You're one of those developers. That's really cool. That's really cool to hear. And the thing is, I can see it when I watched your tutorials and things like that. You can see that this is a person who practices development. Like this is not something that you do to show as some abstract, because you do see this in software. There are people who preach a certain kind of gospel of software development, and they are charlatans, and they say, you know, they're talking about breaking things into a million services, and you see the code that they actually put out, and you're like, oh, I get it. You're trying to impress people with something. And it's so clear that what you're trying to do is get a product shipped and manage trade-offs. But one thing you've learned not to trade away is shipping high quality software that winds up being maintainable. And to somebody like me, it's sort of inspiring, because I want that. That's something that I've always aspired to. But at some points in my career, I felt like maybe it wasn't possible.
Oh, dude, you're not alone, man. This is just a journey, right? There's times I've felt it was impossible. Times I tried to convince teams and lost. And ultimately, you have that same phrase: change your company or change your company, which has happened a few times, for better or worse. But to come all the way back to this whole bringing, you know, back-end devs up to the front-end and TDD and how this all ties together, ultimately I try to use TDD as a way to get these guys on my team who are very passionate about TDD on the server side. I try and hook them on the client side because, as you know, the Ember testing story, thanks to all the awesome core contributors in the Ember side, have literally delivered and handcrafted the greatest test-driven story for the front-end ever. Like, there is nothing that touches it. And showing these guys that join the team that I'm not doing a mocked out, because a lot of these guys actually have come from over mocked, or I like to think their stories remind me of the over mocked JavaScript stuff I did early on, where every single object, like you said earlier, is like, oh, did you mock that you declared the variable and it, you know, it was undefined or whatever. Some of those early tests, I feel like those war stories stay with you. And I think when they joined the team, originally they maybe thought that was the type of JavaScript testing we're doing. And ultimately, based on my experience, my journey, that is obviously not, those aren't valuable tests. And I focus very heavily on behavior. So the first test I often write has to do with, you know, the user goes to this URL, which is already like blowing their mind. They're like, oh, you mean the server URL? And you're like, oh, it's okay. Backup, you know. So you already have to redo that conversation. But a lot of times you're just really flowing. I think of it like, I always ask them, you remember how you wrote a Selenium test? They're like, oh, that was the worst.
The worst.
Like, right. Well, forget it was Selenium. But you remember the experience, the thoughts that you had, the way you felt like you were driving it from the customer's perspective? Right. And I was like, yeah, I know what you're talking about. I'm like, well, that's how we're going to test drive this. They're like, oh, you can do that? I'm like, dude, yeah, that's why we're using Ember.
The four greatest words, I think, in my development arsenal now are Ember, generate, acceptance test. Because that used to be 2 days of setup and bullcrap and just, you know, nightmare. But knowing that getting there was going to be worth this 2-day slog over the mountain. And now you type Ember generate acceptance test and you say visit and you say click and you say, I should see this over here. And there should be three of these things now. It is basically, we use Pretender for fixture stuff and fake servers. And so like, and then you run this suite and it happens in, you know, a split second and you see it physically happen on the screen. Like everything about this is like, wow, this is like everything I ever dreamed of back when I was trying to do like Cucumber and Capybara and all that stuff. But the tools were so cumbersome that I gave up on that style of testing.
Yeah, my favorite quote that I hope blows up, if nothing else from this podcast, is that you still need Selenium and those probably Capybara. I've never actually used that, but it's like more of a high level acceptance ish test, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it uses some sort of fake browser. I can't remember which, but it's very similar. It actually is driving I used Selenium WebKit, so it's using a WebKit based browser to run that behavior, very similar to Selenium.
Okay. And I tell teams and the guys I work with all the time, like, you'll still need those tests. I'm not, you know, Ember testing, as great as it is, I'm not saying don't write a single high-level end-to-end test. You know, what I am saying is that we now have a tool that's like Selenium, but it's actually a feedback tool, what TDD was intended for. Selenium, those WebDriver tests, they are not TDD tools. They're not developer feedback tools. They are regression tests for QA teams or dev teams that don't have QA, which are great. They catch obvious API to client mismatch issues all the time on my team, and I love them for that. But for getting feedback and actually building UIs, Ember testing is like nothing else. And every time I've literally had to stop listening to podcasts that talk about TDD, especially TDD in JavaScript, because if you're not doing Ember, you just don't get it. And it honestly throws me into like a psycho rage, which I'm not normally upset about it, but it's like, I just want to get out and share that message that it is so much better than it was 5 years ago. And I want to help teams get to that point where, you know, we're actually test driving it from the behavior perspective, which completely changes the outlook on, you know, coming back to the whole, like, well, everything's a very brittle test. Well, no, it's not. You know, we're actually testing behavior, not implementation. And if you're not testing implementation, it shouldn't be brittle at all.
Mm-hmm. I think that's super awesome. And like you said, finding that initial common ground with server side devs that may have some resistance and say, no, what you are familiar with and the things that you like about back-end development is actually it's different enough now than what you've been exposed to in trying to cram some JavaScript into your app in the past. It's different enough now and has enough of the good qualities of server-side development that it's a little easier to bring people along than it used to be. And you're seeing a lot more people start to dip their toe in the water with tools like Ember.
And I think what's really cool, another cool story that comes from it that also speaks to how to mentor teams, whether you're doing mentoring front-end or back-end, is you have to do some amount of unlearning, right? So a lot of the guys I work with actually are super senior. Like, I'm garbage on this team. Like, these dudes are awesome. And it's always the same thing from their past experience where the first time I get that Ember testing test running where I literally said, go to this URL, click this button, you know, and then here's the DOM. They always, the first time, go, that's cool, but I want to see it in the browser now. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because they've been in that place where the templates were maybe a stub template and they weren't the real HTML. Uh-huh. And the second we show it in the browser and they're like, whoa, that's exactly what we did. And I'm like, yeah, we just don't need to come here and do the slowed feedback thing anymore.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. That's interesting. I had the same experience very, very recently where people are like, yeah, this test stuff is fine, but show it to me in the browser. Like, oh, that's right. You still need that. Like, you still need that mental confirmation. No. I trust my tests, actually. And it doesn't take long. It only takes a few days before you start trusting them.
I was going to say, like, the credit to my guys is, like, obviously they trust me, and trust and respect are a big part of how you're successful mentoring anyway. Mm-hmm. But, literally, like you said, after this first time, they rarely go back there unless we have some weird, you know, DOM event. Like, today we're actually trying to scroll, which this buddy of mine actually did some scrolling Ember test thing that blew my mind. I was like, that's something I haven't done with Ember testing. So
interesting. Cool. Man, that's awesome. Torin, this is super great conversation, and there's more to explore here. I'd like to bring you back and talk some more about some other stuff after you've had a chance to give your EmberConf talk. I hope a lot of people listening to this are able to make it to EmberConf and see you. We don't have time to get into it, but your style of presenting, I know that you feel like you've done it a bunch, but your style of presenting is the best. Live code, test driven. It's confident. It communicates a lot of information, and it's extremely applicable. So, and the videos will eventually go up. So we'll you know, definitely talk about it more later. But I can't tell you how excited I am about that. And thanks for sharing some of your experiences around bringing teams of people who don't necessarily share the same enthusiasm historically for front end along with you. So thanks
very
much.
I'm stoked. Super awesome to be on the podcast, and obviously be even better to see you guys in EmberConf. So thanks again for having me on.
Yeah, man. We'll see you there.